Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Aaron Weinacht here with the Russian and Eurasian Studies section of the New Books Network. And our guest today is Sean Patterson. And he's got a new book that's called Makhno and Memory. And it's about the Ukrainian anarchist Nestor Makhno. And it's Mennonite narratives about the Ukraine's civil war from 1917 to 1921. So thanks for taking a bit to talk to me about the book, Sean.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So starting off, thought it'd be good to for listeners to know, how'd you come to studying history in general and maybe in just looking at this topic in particular?
For sure. I had always had a deep interest in history, and I guess it started largely in high school. And I became, right from the get-go, really obsessed with Russian history, with the Russian Revolution in particular. But I actually didn't, in university, I started off in Celtic studies, actually, and then eventually switched over to Russian history. What led me to that switchover actually was looking at the Civil War period and starting to look at some of the leftist enemies of the Bolsheviks. So some of these alternative movements that had emerged during the Civil War period, and the Makhnovists were one of these movements that intrigued me. When I did my honors thesis in my undergrad, I looked at Makhno in that, and that's when I first came across Valine's book, The Unknown Revolution, which sort of sets forward kind of the anarchist perspective on the Russian and Civil War period. And I was very fascinated by this movement and the kind of alternative social experiments that they were attempting. So that's sort of how my fascination with Makhno began. And it was also at that point that when I told my family what I was studying, is that I came across sort of the other perspective. So there's the anarchist perspective, but then the Mennonite perspective on Makhno. And I was surprised to learn that they had a very negative view of Makhno and sort of considered him effectively as a mass murderer of their people. I should mention that I grew up in a Mennonite environment. So I was surrounded by Mennonite families, many of whom were directly affected by this. And this Mennonite perspective is, sort of traditionally has not been included in any of the general histories of Makhno, and especially of any sort of more anarchist sympathizing accounts. And it was when I did my MA that I decided to look at this, these conflicting narratives on Makhno and the Mennonites, and try to bring those sources into dialogue with each other. And during my MA, I traveled to Zaporizhia, where these events occurred, which is in southern Ukraine. And I did some research there. Also did extensive research in Winnipeg, where I'm from. And that research for my MA thesis laid the groundwork for this book. And currently I'm at the University of Alberta. I'm a PhD candidate here. I'm continuing to look at the Machinavist movement, looking at it in more of a broader perspective than just the Machinavist Mennonite conflict, but kind of looking at how the Machinavist movement emerged sort of as a movement within a borderland, a colonized borderland. So that's what I'm up to right now.
Well, before we get into the substance of the book here, your rendition there prompts me to ask, why do you think that is, that the Mennonite view is so often left out, as you said, in the general histories? Is this what we're, you know, all caught up in you know, Bolshevism, or why is that?
I think that there's a number of reasons why that perspective sort of went to the wayside. For one, a lot of the earlier literature on Machno came from a pro-anarchist, or at least a sympathetic perspective to him. So they were generally avoidant of you know, something that would make the movement look that bad, as some of the Mennonite accounts do. There's also more recently, there's been attempts to kind of integrate Machno into the you know, sort of Ukrainian pantheon of heroes of the nation. So you know, the Mennonite issue kind of complicates that, right? It makes it more difficult.
Pacifist isn't a good PR campaign.
Yes, exactly. I think there's also, like you mentioned, there's sort of in our field, there's always been a you know, very strong focus on sort of the main players of the Civil War. So the Bolsheviks and the White Army and these other movements and groups were for a very long time not looked at, or just looked at in very, very specialized studies, or in the case of Mennonites, looked at, you know, within their own scholarship. But that's rapidly changing, especially now with these more recent calls to, you know, decolonize the field of Slavic studies and begin to look at some of these narratives and stories that have had a lot less attention put on them.
Hmm. Well, that's cool to find in graduate school something that really actually hasn't been done.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Since that's what we're supposed to do. okay. So that being said, since Machno may or may not be somebody who's real familiar to listeners, I thought maybe you could start us off by discussing two things. Maybe first, who Machno was, and, you know, how he fits into the broader anarchist movement, and then how Mennonite colonists came to be in the Ukraine and Russian Empire. Those both strike me as subjects that listeners could probably use a bit of a primer on.
For sure, yeah. So who is Machno? I mean, that's a central question of my book that I've struggled with, and that actually, you know, even the people closest to him, right, had struggled with. I start my book off with a quote from Volin, who I mentioned wrote that book, The Unknown Revolution. And Volin, for a period in 1919, had spent a long time with him, and said that he still, despite spending almost every day with him, still couldn't penetrate sort of the enigma of Machno's personality. So there's a real difficulty in pinning down exactly who he was and what he stood for in that. But but, you know, on the surface level, you can say that Machno, he was a Ukrainian peasant, and he was an ideological anarchist. He was born in 1888. Interestingly, he was born on the same day as the revolution, the October Revolution, and also the Eichenfeld massacre, which which I discuss in the book later on. But it's sort of just an interesting, strange coincidence that he happens to be born on both these dates. But he came from a poor peasant background. Both of his parents were serfs. He talks a lot about in his memoirs. He mentions sort of the abuse that his mother and father had experienced as serfs, and he discusses growing up very poor, having to start work as a child laborer from the age of 8. He describes in his memoirs working on Mennonite and German estates, and they're experiencing and witnessing abuse in the workplace, which generated in him, according to his memoirs, he says it generated a deep hatred of class enemies. When he was a teenager, so I believe around 16 or 17 years old, he joined the local anarcho-communist group in Juliapolia. Juliapolia is a sort of medium-sized, it's often described as a village, but it's probably more like a large town or small city. And it's in southern Ukraine. But he joins this anarcho-communist group, which is kind of it's a reading group, but it's also we could describe as a terrorist organization. I mean, they go around, they rob local wealthy merchants and landowners, and that they're engaged in a number of murders. At one point, they start burning down estates. They also get into a battle with the local police, and it ends up in the assassination of the local police chief. Makhno himself is involved in an attempted plot to blow up a secret police station, and he's arrested during that plot. He's charged with terrorist offenses and sentenced to death. However, this death sentence is commuted due to his age to life in a life of labor in prison. And he's sentenced to Butyrki prison in Moscow, which was sort of a notorious prison for holding a lot of political prisoners at the time. It's in prison that he deepens his knowledge of anarchism. He's sort of exposed to a lot of different figures in prison from a variety of ideologies, although he becomes quite very good friends with Pyotr Arshinov. Arshinov is a Russian anarchist who becomes quite well known during the revolution as well, and later joins up with Makhno in the movement. So they forge a very strong friendship in prison. Makhno describes in prison sort of carrying around Kropotkin's mutual aid with him everywhere, and sort of discussing anarchist philosophy and these issues in prison. He's eventually released along with Arshinov during the February Revolution in 1917, and there was a kind of broad political prisoner amnesty that releases these political prisoners. He's released, he goes back to his hometown and starts organizing peasants and workers in the region. He quite quickly is able to kind of assert his power in the town and gather a following around him. He organizes a peasants' union. There, he becomes the leader of the, I believe, the Metal Workers and Carpenters Union as well, and they start to organize confiscation of the local estates, some of which are Mennonite estates, which they transform into communes. So that's sort of up. We're talking here like up to the October Revolution when the Bolsheviks take power. Then you have to also remember that World War I is occurring at the same time. And the Bolsheviks, when they come into power, in order to end World War I or remove themselves from the conflict, they sign a treaty with the Germans, which effectively cedes most of Ukraine to Germany and Austria-Hungary. And so Machno's region comes under Austro-German occupation during this period. That initially pushes Machno out of the region, and he will only return quite a bit later in 1918 to organize an underground insurgency against the German occupation. German occupation was horribly unpopular. It provoked widespread insurgency all across Ukraine. So the emergence of what comes to be called the Makhnovshchina is during this period, is this insurgent period, and it's sort of part of a much broader rebellion against the German occupation. Machno, and this is also the critical period where sort of the tensions between Mennonites and Machno and his followers flares up, because it's under the Germans, the German occupation, that the Germans begin to arm the Mennonites, who traditionally were pacifist, right? However, many of them were very concerned about what would happen if and when the Germans left, right? What would happen to their property and also to their livelihoods? And so particularly the youth, Mennonite youth, begin to be drilled by Germans and are armed. And sort of near the end of the German occupation, you have these Selbstschutz units or self-defense units that emerge on the Mennonite colonies. And now, even before the Germans leave, some of the people associated with these units begin to accompany the Germans on expeditionary on expeditions into Ukrainian villages. So what was going on is that they were, the Germans were hunting down, insurgents inside Ukrainian villages. They were trying to retrieve stolen property, so property that had been taken during the 1917 revolution. And you have multiple accounts from various sides that both Mennonites and German colonists on occasion did accompany these German units, or acted as informants on for the German forces. So this starts to generate a lot of resentment between local peasants who were generally supportive of the insurgency and the Mennonite colonies, who largely embraced the German occupation. Now there's one particular incident during this time where there's a village, a Ukrainian village, that's effectively burned to the ground by the Germans. And Machno describes this in detail in his memoirs. It's mentioned in other Machnovist accounts as well. There were German colonists that accompanied the German forces that burned this Ukrainian village down. It's not clear whether they were Mennonite colonists, but it's just we know that there were German colonists, and that Machno seems to have been quite traumatized by what happened there. He describes his memoirs attempting or almost committing suicide and beginning this, what he describes as a campaign of sword and fire against counter-revolutionary forces, of which are included Mennonite and German colonists. And he also, it's also at this point in his memoirs that he describes destroying a German Catholic colony. So there's kind of this a very quick escalation in attacks on Mennonites and Germans at that moment. this is right at the end of the German occupation of Ukraine. They very soon after leave, and the immediate region around Huleypolia is quite like the Mennonite colonies are just devastated by attacks and robbery. It forces a lot of them to flee south to other Mennonite colonies, and that's where they sort of the Selbstschutz establishes a kind of front line against Machnevist forces, and the Selbstschutz begin collaboration with the White Army as well at that point. On Machno's side, they forge an alliance, a temporary alliance with the Bolsheviks, and they sort of have this back and forth battle that happens, and during which, you know, once again, there's a lot of resentment from the fighting between these two sides that grows. I guess just to sort of carry the narrative forward a little bit, it's later in 1919 and fall 1919 where we see the worst of the attacks between these two sides. In mid 1919, the White Army had taken over large swaths of Ukraine, particularly southern and eastern Ukraine, as they were pushing up to make an attack on Moscow. Right, that had pushed Makhno's forces to the west of so more towards central Ukraine. Now, in the fall, Makhno begins a counteroffensive into the rear of the White Army, and causes massive disruption. And actually manages to take an enormous area of southern Ukraine. He captures at this point numerous major cities like what is today Dnipro and Zaporizhia, Berdyansk, and of course all of the various Mennonite colonies. And it's at this point of where sort of at the peak of Machno's power that you see these large scale massacres occur. So in a period of about 6 weeks, there's over 800 Mennonites that are murdered in various massacres by forces that identify themselves or are aligned with the Machnevists. So that's sort of just the a survey history of Machno the person and this conflict that emerges between Mennonites and Machnevists.
So how do then do the, up to this point, we're taking for granted that there's Mennonite settlers in Ukraine. So how do they get there?
Yeah, for sure. They came in the 1700s under Catherine II. So southern Ukraine was colonized by Catherine II. It had been kind of this... it had been kind of a contested area. So Zaporizhia in southern Ukraine, there were Cossacks living there. There were peasants, Ukrainian peasants, and there were also a lot of Turkish and Tatar raids into Zaporizhia during that period. So Imperial Russia, Catherine the Great, there's a lot of alliances that are made with the Zaporizhian Cossacks to defeat the Turkish, the Turks and Tatars in that area. Eventually, they take this area, and it's at that point that Imperial Russia starts to colonize Zaporizhia. This involves destroying the Zaporizhian Cossacks' capital, imprisoning some of their leaders, co-opting some of them into the administration. In the case of the poorer Cossacks, in that some of them are enserfed, and serfdom in general is introduced into the area at that time. So in this attempt to colonize the region and build it up economically, Catherine II invites foreign colonists. So this includes a wide variety of people. There's Greeks and Bulgarians and Swedes and Serbians and all that that come into this region to help work the land and that. And the Mennonites and other German religious groups are brought in at this time. The Mennonites are able to come up with an agreement with Imperial Russia. It's called the Privilegium, and it outlined special privileges that they had. So some of these privileges were they had an exemption from military service. They had lower taxes and such. So these are sort of benefits to entice them to come into the area. So they come in. Initially, they struggle. There's a lot of hardship, and the land is certainly not as good as it was advertised to them initially. And as is often the case, right? But eventually they become very, very exceptional farmers in the region. And so Mennonites as a community generate a lot of wealth in their communities, and they accumulated a lot of land. However, it should be pointed out that the Mennonites themselves experienced a massive land crisis in the 1800s, where you had as many as half of them were landless, right? And this had to do with the land tenure that Mennonites practiced of passing on their land entirely intact. They didn't divide it up, right? As a lot of peasants did, they divided their lands up between their between the sons, right? So the Mennonites passed it on intact. So that left out, you know, certain people. So they would end up landless. So in order to deal with this landlessness problem, they started buying up more land, generally from former Russian nobles who owned large swaths of land or estates in the area. And they created these sub-colonies, or what they call daughter colonies, where the landless Mennonites could now have their own land as well. That, however, did bring them into conflict with some of the Ukrainian peasants that lived in the region, because the whole, you know, how the land was work, what access they had to rivers and forests, and that all had to be renegotiated. And sometimes there were what Ukrainian peasants felt were very, you know, exceptionally high fees were levied, say, to access, a water source or forest, or to rent the land, also to rent land, and that the fee, they felt that the prices were very high. In the Eichenfeld situation that I describe in my book, there's evidence of these type of tensions of sort of that there were tensions about the prices, the access to the river, all this kind of stuff that contributed towards what happened there.
Can I interject a quick question there?
Yeah, for sure.
The narrative you're sketching out so far makes me wonder. So after 1861, when they as a result of peasant emancipation, you got all those redemption payments. So if after that point, if there are Mennonites buying up noble estates, do those peasants' redemption payments transfer to the new owners, or does that end them?
I'm not entirely sure if it. I don't believe that it ever transferred to these redemption payments ever transferred to the Mennonites. I didn't come across any evidence that they were paying out redemption payments to them. But it was more that because in terms of the redemption payments, that would have been for the land that the peasants themselves had, right? So they owned it, but the Mennonites weren't buying up that land. They were buying up like separate lands that these Russian nobles had, right?
Just occurred to me that if you're looking for reasons for bad blood, if that was the case, that might figure prominently.
For sure, yeah. I think what was going on more was that it had more to do with the like the sharecropping and that. The peasants that were renting out land from, so Mennonites who came into this noble, these noble lands that they bought up, and then they were renting that land out to peasants who felt that the prices were exceptionally high. There was also resentment sometimes about how all these lands were laid out, like geographically laid out. So there's accounts of Ukrainian peasants being angry that they had to, you know, walk through large amount of Mennonite owned land just to get to their their strips of land. So there's sort of this there's all kinds of resentments about the arrangement and how land had been bought up and who's renting it out at what price and that. I think that's always really important to keep in mind about this topic, right? Is sort of the socioeconomics of what's going on at the ground, you know, and that's, you know, beside any of the political and ideological elements that come up during the Civil War, are these economic issues that are already generating a lot of resentment amongst the population.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So now that we've got the kind of call that the background on the table, then maybe next what we ought to do is have you sketch out, so what actually happens at these massacres? Like, when are they? What are the, you know, are there immediate causes? You can just go over kind of the centerpiece of events of the book.
Sure. Yeah. So the massacres themselves, this is the third part of my book, and I focus, I focus mainly on the Eichenfeld massacre, which occurs, as I mentioned, this period in fall 1919, in which Machno's forces slam into the rear guard of Denikin's White Army, and they take over a large area of southern Ukraine, including the majority of pretty much all of the colonies in that area. Eichenfeld is part of the Yasukovo colony that's close to modern day Dnipro. It's just south of it, and so there's various patterns that cut across even beyond Eichenfeld to all of the massacres. So one common element is the presence of these Selbstschutz units in most of the main massacres. You have presence of a Selbstschutz unit which has been fighting against both, you know, Bolsheviks and Makhnovists for quite a while, and even in 1919, continuing to attempt to fend off some of these to fend off Makhnovist forces. Now it should be pointed out, it's not in every case. There were massacres that occurred where there was no Selbstschutz, because that's one of the main sort of main controversies is, you know, what, you know, should the Selbstschutz be, you know, blamed for what happened, right? And did they that they kind of provoke it by their presence. But
yeah, I did want to ask about that.
Yeah, yeah, and it's that's a very important question. But there is the pattern that they were present, or there was a force present at most of these massacres. I think that in terms of culpability, it shouldn't. My feeling is that it shouldn't be looked at as did they cause these massacres. There were many reasons for the massacres, and the Zilbschutz is one component which was used by those who committed the massacres to rationalize and justify what they were doing, what they did. So I don't think that saying that they sort of singularly were the cause of it, or even a main, I mean, yeah, even a main cause necessarily, because it's hard to say whether if the Zilbschutz had not been present, you know, would these massacres, they could have occurred even without the Zilbschutz there. However, they are a catalyst that's present for this to happen. So you have that present. You also have what I mentioned about the sort of these resentments about land and the arrangements and the payments. There's also, because the revolution, particularly in the countryside, right, was about taking land and, you know, the peasants taking the land back, right, taking what they believed was theirs. So there's a lot of these massacres are premised on the local Ukrainian villages absorbing that land. That was very clear in the evidence for Eichenfeld is what was going on there, because they when the massacre was occurring, it seems that they were very focused on who was landowners, who was not, and they were specifically targeting landowners and their sons. So that it appears that there was a very clear effort to eliminate that land owning heritage. And so with Eichenfeld itself, there's also the element of at that moment there was a large transfer of Makhnovist troops between Zaporizhia city and what is now Dnipro. And so they were moving from Oleksandrovsk, Zaporizhia, up to Dnipro or Katerinoslav. And so on that day where the massacre happens, there's literally thousands of troops passing through there. It appears that local peasants from some of the eyewitness reports had recruited some of these Makhnovists to go and attack the village. So you have a coming together of local peasants from nearby villages and these Makhnovist units. And there also is the another added layer of that the Makhnovist counterintelligence was sort of ferreting out all these Zilbschutz units, and Eichenfeld had a particularly bothersome unit that they were attempting to take out. And so on the day of the massacre, what you notice is that the father of the leader of the local Zilbschutz is the first person killed. And that's the father was murdered because they mistook him for the actual leader, because they had the same name. So that you also have these Makhnovist counterintelligence units operating in the region, and they're trying to take out Zilbschutz leaders. So there's many interlocking layers and factors that come together to make these massacres happen. There's some of them are broader factors that, you know, you can kind of apply to all of the massacres that occur in this region. And then there's very localized particular factors, right, that cause this.
So you've sketched out in the book, by contrast with this extremely, I don't think I'm overdoing it here, extremely complex situation that both the the post facto Makhnovist narrative is oversimplified, and perhaps the post facto Mennonite narrative is oversimplified as well. So I thought maybe it'd be helpful for listeners if you could explain, like, you know, why are those narratives, where are they oversimplified? Maybe where they're right, but where do those narratives break down in light of the extremely complex situation on the ground?
Yeah, for sure. The Makhnovist narrative, obviously, there's sort of a propagandistic element, right? That they wanted to present the positive aspects of their movement, and many of the memoirs were written in exile, right? So in exile, Makhno summer 1921 flees to Europe. Eventually, he ends up in Paris alongside other leaders and ideological figures of the movement. They're writing to sort of justify the movement to an international audience, particularly other radicals and anarchists around the world. There were a lot of accusations against Makhno that his forces were involved in banditry and anti-Semitism, pogroms, right? So Makhno was constantly on the defensive about this and constantly defending his movement. And you can see the same in Arshinov's book and to a large extent in Volin's book of emphasizing the positive characteristics over these negative characteristics, and understandably. And it should be said that the movement did have, like, they did attempt to introduce a lot of these constructive policies of anarchism. They did carry out experiments in radical grassroots democracy, and they did carry out experiments in direct barter, sort of cashless economy, and they so there were and a lot, I mean, it was a very popular movement. The popularity of the movement, for many peasants, they experienced it as a liberatory movement. So there is that. There is the positive aspect of the movement there. However, as I mentioned in the book, the Makhnovists, they never mention Mennonites once. It's never talked about. They occasionally mention German colonists, that the Mennonites are sort of absorbed under that label of German colonist. So, but they don't make the differentiation, and they certainly don't ever talk about the 1919 massacres. As I mentioned, Makhno does talk about in 1918 destroying a particular German Catholic village. In his wife's diary, she also mentions destroying a German Lutheran colony at one point. So there are occasional hints of this violence inside the literature, but it's never sort of looked at in depth by them. They do address, Volin particularly does address the violence, and he criticizes the movement for the violence, particularly the army. And he accuses the army of engaging in rape, which was a problem inside the army. There's sort of propagandistic reasons for how they're narrativizing the history in that. On the Mennonite side, there's very much you don't see any of the, you know, they rarely talk about any of the sort of social experiments that the Makhnovists are doing. They talk only about sort of the devastation that they experienced. And in fact, in a lot of cases, I don't think they were even aware of the social experiments that the Makhnovists were carrying out simultaneous to all of this violence that's going on. So that can partly explain, you know, why in Mennonite literature, you don't have a more maybe more complex sort of investigation of the movement. And it's particularly its ideology. Generally, it's the anarchism of Makhno is described as just sort of chaotic, and their their aim is simply to just create havoc and chaos. An example, actually, that I mention in the book of sort of not being aware of the constructive aspects of the movement simultaneous to the negative aspects is there's one Mennonite who describes participating in a local election. And he says that the workers and peasants of the area had decided to carry out these elections. And he actually, this Mennonite, I believe he was a teacher, found himself elected to the local Soviet. And but he at the same time, he immediately after that, he says that the Makhnovists had no platform, no program. Their only purpose was to create chaos. And so, but little did he know that these elections were organized by Makhnovists, and that at the larger, so he was elected as a local representative, but those local representatives also elected representatives to go to a larger congress in Alexandrovsk, and there they did actually develop a very detailed program that sort of was it acted as the main statement of the movement on sort of what their ideological and social vision was. So a lot of the times in the literature, how one side constructs the other is a byproduct of kind of their isolation from each other's perspectives. And that,
you know, something that you've touched on this a little bit with regard to those privileges you discussed earlier that the colonists had from the Russian state. And that brings up another question I'd wanted to ask you. You know, we usually talk in stories about unsung heroes, but it seems to me that, the Russian state is really kind of the unsung villain of your book, in that, you correct me if I get this wrong, but my impression is that basically when the First World War broke out, the Russian state kind of sicked the nationalist dogs on the German colonists had formerly given, privilege to. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So there were tensions developing between the Russian government and Mennonites and other German colonists. It reached a fever in World War I, and that led to the government passing these land liquidation laws, right? Which was basically that all German land was going to be confiscated and redistributed. And they began this land liquidation. It mainly affected non-Mennonite German colonists in 1916, but they were sort of the government was attempting to expand it to Mennonites, but Mennonites made the argument that they weren't actually German, they were Dutch, based on their historical lineage and the dialect, this particular dialect that they spoke. I believe there were some Swiss German colonists as well that made a similar argument, right? Hmm. They weren't actually German, and so there was really just nitpicky kind of nitpicking on genealogy for a while there to try and sort of prevent the expropriation of their land.
Call it strategic sophistry.
Yeah. And I mean, it was to some extent, I mean, like, it could be argued, right? Because this is a whole other in Mennonite studies, right? Of who are Mennonites? It goes into identity and how do we construct identity, right? Who are these Mennonites, Russian Mennonites, right? Are they German, right? A lot of them identified at the time as, culturally German, but it's true. They did come from the Netherlands originally. They spoke a dialect that was sort of had a lot of Dutch influence in it. So it also goes to how do groups of people construct each other. And I think that's still something that Mennonites today will debate and talk about.
You know, since you bring up the idea of identity construction, something that occurred to me when I was reading the book was, you know, is this from the, Mach Nova's perspective, which is, you know, really based around social class. Like, you know, it's been argued, I'm thinking here of somebody like Eric Weitz, it's been argued that in effect, Russian Marxism turned class into race with a kind of, you know, heritable, you know, class status and so on. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at here, is it possible for Mennonite colonists, you know, to become to be seen as the good guys from the Mach Nova's perspective? Or is it the case that from that anarchist perspective that they're kind of locked into this one identity that they can't escape because of their, you know, ethnic heritage or something like that?
Yeah, so you're sort of approaching this intersection, right, of class and ethnicity, and how do they work together in this period? That's something that I find particularly fascinating about this topic, because it, you know, as you noted there, that the Mach Nova in their rhetoric, right, it's solidly based on social class. Everything, their rationalizations and their propaganda are all, it's all, we're doing this in the name of class conflict. They explicitly issue out many of their propaganda leaflets, and that they explicitly condemn any attacks based on ethnicity. This is particularly in the case of Jews. They repeatedly emphasize that attacks on Jews should not be made on the basis of ethnicity, but they say it's across the board. Germans, Russians, Ukrainians, all shouldn't be any ethnic attacks. However, you know, when it's more complex than this, right? Because especially in the case of Mennonites and German colonists, you have a tight link between wealth and ethnicity there in the region, right? So you have wealth that's concentrated in particular groups, right? And so how then if the Mach Nova are targeting particular people based on class and based on wealth, you inevitably disproportionately end up with particular groups being targeted more, right? So there's an ethnic element, just sort of an inherent in that process because of the way that wealth is distributed in the region. Now at the same time, like that you do have at the rank and file level, you have people, you have soldiers, you have accounts of soldiers, Mach Nova soldiers, expressing Germanophobia. There's, and definitely anti-Semitism is there. There's complaints from Mach Nova commanders, like inside the army, they're complaining of their, some of their troops that have been infected by anti-Semitism. Some of the anarchist intellectuals, many of whom were Jewish, operating inside the movement, are complaining about anti-Semitism at the rank and file. And then you have accounts from Mennonites of Mach Nova saying that, you know, they're gonna kill all Germans and this kind of rhetoric. So you have to also kind of separate what's going on, like some of the more cruder expressions of ethnic animosity that's occurring at the rank and file level from the rhetoric that's occurring, the more ideological rhetoric that's occurring at the propaganda level or at the level of the command leadership. And there's always kind of a tension there between the command and the rank and file, and, you know, like what violence is permissible and what is not. Like, where do we draw the boundaries? You know, what is ethnic violence, right, versus not, right? So if Mach Nova go in and they destroy a market, they rob a market in a city that's largely run by Jews, is that a pogrom, right? Or is that based on class, right? So these are some of the questions that they were constantly grappling with. And I don't think they ever arrived at a sufficient solution to how to grapple with this. Another issue, just to keep talking about, yeah, I guess the whole anti-Semitism issue is that in 1919, in summer 1919, they integrated a large force of it was a separate independent force that they integrated into their army, who were notorious for pogroms. This was Grigoryev's forces. He was a separate sort of warlord. Makhno killed him on the basis of anti-Semitism. However, then integrated his forces, which had been culpable for pogroms. This contradiction and paradox, right, is that you have opposing anti-Semitism, but at the same time integrating forces that are responsible for brutal atrocities against Jews. It ends up, Volin explains that it ends up that they had to dismiss many of these units that they had integrated because they were just simply too corrupted by anti-Semitism. So, these are just some of the sort of how complex that intersection between ethnicity and class is and how it was tackled at the grassroots level. Just one more factor is that within the Makhnovist army, you do have some German and Mennonite colonists that join them. It's rare, but there are eyewitness accounts of even Mennonites participating in the massacres in their own villages, and you have accounts also of Mennonites who go into the army and even achieve some status within the army. There's one case of a Mennonite named Peter Thiessen, who was rechristened to Petka Thiessen, and he became the sort of right-hand man of the commandant, Makhnovist commandant of Alexandrovsk, so that's Zaporizhia city today, for a time. And the commandant also had a partial German background as well. So the Makhnovists didn't see necessarily, if you came from a German or Mennonite background, then you're eternally the enemy. Rather, it was sort of you could become a Makhnovist if on class basis, right, or if you sort of turn against your past and join them, right. So it wasn't this kind of universal blacklisting of anybody from a particular ethnicity. So it's very complicated. Many factors involved in this.
Maybe this is just my, kind of idiosyncrasies, but that brings up to me what's one of the kind of profounder ironies of this whole situation, which is that radical Protestants have always seemed to me to be some of history's original anarchists themselves. And yeah. So to me, that just, I don't know. I mean, albeit of a different kind than Mike Noah was, obviously, but still, it seems like a really, really kind of profound irony of this scenario to me.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's something that in the research and writing of this book that I, would in my own mind keep going back to is that, the Anabaptists were in many ways anarchistic, right?
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
Yeah, that they, the rejection of the state, some of the more communal ways of sharing property and that.
And kind of economic autarky to an extent.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the book, that Kropotkin, so that was, if listeners don't know who he is, he's sort of the god, one of the godfathers of Russian anarchism or anarchism even as a whole. And he traveled to Canada and he visited Mennonite colonies here in Canada. And he was quite impressed by them. And he had critiques of the religion. However, he was very impressed with the way that they organized themselves and felt that there was an affinity with his ideas. That's absolutely is there. And however, in Ukraine, and in the Russian Empire, the way that history unfolded, it ended up that the Mennonites there were more, at least initially, more aligned with imperial Russia, right? Because they were an integral part of the colonization project of the region, right? So they became entangled in imperial goals, right? I think there's an unwittingness to all of this, because they're often in the literature doesn't seem to be a consciousness of how much they were integrated into that kind of imperial project. And then also their economic success in the region, which ended up generating a lot of resentment from local peasants.
We're kind of running short of time here, and maybe now would be a good time to kind of wrap it up and ask, my impression is that you're kind of continuing with this overall research topic. And so I was kind of wondering if you could, tell listeners where you're headed next. And then I was also curious if the current conflict in Ukraine is affecting your research on these matters at all. Do you have enough sources to keep going, or is this going to interfere with, research travels?
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely a story behind all that. So in terms of my research, yes, I'm continuing on researching the Makhnovist movement, looking at it more broadly beyond just the Makhnovist Mennonite conflict. I'm wanting to sort of look at the movement as not trying to move beyond these sort of singular explanations of the movement as, fundamentally anarchist or fundamentally kind of a criminal group or even fundamentally like a kind of a ethnic or national movement. But I'm wanting to understand it more as a byproduct of that colonization process of southern Ukraine and as emergent as a movement out of a borderland region. As part of that, I'm very interested, again, like we were talking about, that intersection between ethnicity and class and how that operates. I'm also very interested in how did the ideology of the movement change over its existence, and then how was that narrativized in exile, and how did their ideology and perspective change in exile? In terms of doing the research itself, first the pandemic and now the war in Ukraine has severely impacted my ability to do the research and to go to the region. I'm not able to go to the region. The front line of the war right now is right on Khudaypolya, where this is Makhno's hometown. It's been an interesting and actually in a way a very, very positive experience to sort of connect with researchers and scholars from the region and share information, right? So it's kind of been an experience of mutual aid itself, right?
Very Kropotkin-esque there.
Yeah. It's been a very good experience in terms of exchanging information and research and documents, and so that's really what has allowed me to continue to do this research is effectively the generosity of a lot of people who are still living in that region. There also is other institutions that I've been able to get information from that are outside of Ukraine and Russia. For instance, I recently went to the New York Public Library, and they hold an extensive collection of anarchist newspapers, and some of which are Makhnevist newspapers, and also newspapers and pamphlets of a group that was closely aligned with the Makhnevists, the Nabat Confederation. They're a Ukrainian anarchist group that had sent a lot of intellectuals into the movement in 1919. So that also was was an amazing experience to be able to go down there and find that material, which actually interesting was had kind of been was lost. It was the material was known, but then when they switched over to their digital catalog, that it wasn't cataloged there. So there's sort of been a rediscovery of that material more recently. So it was great to go there and consult that. In July, my plan is to go to Amsterdam. There's the International Institute of Social History there, and they contain a lot of papers and archives of anarchists who were aligned with Machno, or who got to know him in exile. I'm especially interested in Volin's archive is held there. So I'm particularly interested in taking a look at his archive.
Well, I'll look forward to reading that when you get finished with it. Whenever you turn it into a book, call me and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, for sure.
So we can revisit this subject here in another few years. So, well, thanks for taking the time to give us a rundown on this. It's not often that, I guess you might say, history catches up with a historical subject like this. Anyway, thanks for your time, and you have a good rest of your day.
Well, thank you very much. You take care.